Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 18th of July, these are our main stories. The US government's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says all Americans should wear masks to stop a sharp rise in coronavirus cases. The American Defense Secretary has, in effect, banned the flying of the Confederate flag at all US military sites. There's been little sign of progress at a summit where EU leaders are attempting to agree a huge COVID-19 stimulus package. Also in this podcast, Arise Sir Tom, the centenarian who's been knighted by Queen Elizabeth for raising millions of dollars during the pandemic.
Never, never, ever did I imagine that I should get so close to the Queen and have such a kind message from her. That was really outstanding.
The wearing of face masks in the United States has become a battle between health experts and politicians. The country's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has urged all Americans to wear face coverings as the country struggles to control a sustained surge in coronavirus infections. And he remains optimistic that a solution to the pandemic will be found.
We've been going through this very difficult period for the last 5.5, 6 months. And sometimes you get so exasperated and run down by it that you think it's never going to end. It will end. It will end through public health measures. And science, I can tell you, will come to our rescue.
Dr. Anthony Fauci. In Georgia, the Republican Governor Brian Kemp pursued legal action against the mayor of Atlanta for making face coverings compulsory. Now, Mr. Kemp says,
today I'm encouraging all Georgians from every corner of the state to wear a mask when out in public, or when you cannot distance yourself inside. Now, I know that many well-intentioned and well-informed Georgians want a mask mandate. And while we all agree that wearing a mask is effective, I'm confident that Georgians don't need a mandate to do the right thing.
Georgia Governor Brian Kemp. I asked our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, if we're seeing a wholesale change in attitude to wearing masks in the U.S.
No, I don't think we are. And I think it's worth saying in terms of Brian Kemp, he would certainly argue that he's not done a U-turn. He would say, I have always been against the forced wearing of masks, but I've always been in favour of recommending to people that they wear them. And indeed, he would say that he's just been on a tour of Georgia encouraging people to wear masks. And this goes to the root of the issue here. This is about America's and Americans, for some of them at least, the concern about overreach by government. This isn't necessarily just confined to face masks. It touches all sorts of areas of life, and particularly on the conservative right, there is this fear of government interference and a resistance to be forced to do anything.
But do you think the medics have won the argument on the coronavirus and wearing masks?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of confusion at the beginning, to be fair. The CDC wasn't very clear on its advice on mask wearing. The president, of course, resisted for a very long time and was only seen for the first time last weekend wearing a mask. But increasingly, you are seeing states, even in the South, encouraging and mandating people to wear masks. There's a real mixture in those Republican-controlled states of people who are leaving up to local municipalities, which is not what Georgia is doing, and those which are saying, well, actually, we're going to stop you doing that statewide. So there's a real mixture of approaches, but the prevalence of mask wearing is growing wider. And indeed, you're looking at around, I think, at least 24 states, including the District of Columbia, where I am, where in certain circumstances where you can't socially distance, mask wearing is mandated.
And how important is it, do you think, that President Trump was seen wearing a mask in public for the first time, I think, on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, it was a moment. There's no question about that, given that he has made a point of saying that he doesn't need to, doesn't want to. I mean, he's veered between I don't need to because I'm constantly being tested and all the people around me are being tested to I wouldn't look good in it, would I? So his justifications have changed. But there is, I think, at least some kind of movement there from him by doing that. We'll see if he does it again. Bear in mind, he was in a hospital setting meeting veterans at the time. So in some ways, if you're not going to do it when you're visiting sick veterans in hospital, then when are you?
So, Gary, what do you think this tells us about where you are with the pandemic in the US?
Well, the numbers are terrible here. There's no question about that. If you look at the seven-day rolling number of infections, we're well over 60,000 as a seven-day average. That is around three times larger than it was 4 weeks ago. So you can see the level of infection is rising, the level of hospitalisation is rising, and the predictions are that, you know, perhaps even by November you could be looking at, you know, approaching a quarter of a million deaths in this country.
Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue. The US Defence Secretary Mark Esper has, in effect, banned the flying of the Confederate flag at American military bases around the world. He's prohibited what he called divisive symbols, but doesn't directly reference the flag. Ali Makbul reports.
In a memo, Mark Esper talked of treating all people with dignity and respect. While the flag was never actually adopted by the Confederate States of America that during the Civil War were fighting to keep slavery, it later came to represent them and has long been used by a large number of white supremacist groups here, including the Ku Klux Klan. President Trump's defended the Confederate flag's use, though, in the name of free speech. Interestingly, the Defense Secretary in his statement chose to list the flags that were permitted as opposed to explicitly detailing those that weren't.
Ali Makbul. Argentina's government has announced it'll begin to ease lockdown restrictions imposed 4 months ago in the Buenos Aires metropolitan area. The death rate has been far lower in Argentina than in neighbouring Brazil and Chile. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
President Alberto Fernandez went on national television to thank all Argentines for their sacrifice. He was one of the first leaders in Latin America to close borders and ban people from leaving their homes to slow the spread of the coronavirus. But after 4 months of restrictions in the capital, Buenos Aires, business leaders and the opposition said the lockdown was unrealistic and was destroying the economy. Mr. Fernandez said the quarantine had saved thousands of lives, and the number of infections had gone down in recent weeks.
Leonardo Rocha. European Union leaders in Brussels have spent hours trying to thrash out an agreement on the bloc's future finances at their first face-to-face summit of the coronavirus crisis. Elbow bumps and face coverings were in evidence, but there was no masking the policy gaps. This report from our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly.
As the EU leaders gathered, the usual handshakes and backslaps were replaced with elbow bumps, bows and playful salutes. But the problems which faced them were more familiar. How much money should the EU spend and how tightly should it monitor what member states do with it? The next seven-year budget will be around €1 trillion, but alongside it will stand a COVID recovery fund, a further €750 billion. Richer northern states like the Netherlands and Austria think recovery funds should be given as loans to be repaid, not grants, and should be subject to tight political supervision. Poorer southern states, the likely beneficiaries, strongly disagree. Angela Merkel says bridging that gap will not be easy.
I have to say that there are still some very, very big differences, and I can't say whether we will reach an agreement this time. It would be preferable, but we need to face reality, and it really needs some major willingness to compromise from everyone so we can agree on something that would be good for Europe, would be good for the people in the face of the pandemic.
The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, was more optimistic, saying all the pieces needed for a deal are on the table.
Kevin Connolly. In the UK, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says coronavirus restrictions in England will ease under a plan to return to significant normality by the end of the year. After confusing messages about people returning to work, Mr. Johnson now says employers will get more discretion to ask employees to return to the workplace. Indoor gyms and pools will be able to open later this month, and from August, leisure centres and casinos will be able to open, and wedding receptions with up to 30 people will be allowed. At the same time, the Prime Minister handed powers to councils for local lockdowns in case of rising infections.
From tomorrow, local authorities will have new powers in their areas. They will be able to close specific premises, shut public outdoor spaces, and cancel events. These powers will enable local authorities to act more quickly in response to outbreaks where speed is paramount.
I asked our correspondent, Jessica Parker, what a significant return to normality means.
It partly means, and there's a big underlying context here, that ministers really want to get the economy going. There are huge concerns about the possibility of major unemployment. As you've seen in a lot of countries across the world, there has been this big support for businesses to just help people pay their wages during the lockdown. But that is easing off as we approach the autumn. So I think the emphasis from the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to try and get more people back into the office in England. I think that's partly about productivity. I think it's also partly about passing trade. You'll know that when you head into town centres, city centres, you're more likely maybe to pick up a sandwich or go for a drink after work, spend a bit of money. Those businesses, of course, have suffered hugely. But matched with a kind of roadmap to ease restrictions, the Prime Minister was very clear. It's all conditional on controlling the virus. It's conditional on people behaving, as he put it, responsibly. But he did dangle this big hope over people, which was, he suggested, possibly, maybe, there could be some kind of significant return to normality by Christmas. Now, he did leave himself some wriggle room by saying everything was conditional.
I suppose we should point out as well, this isn't necessarily going to happen now with the other nations that make up the UK. They are in a different lockstep.
Yeah, it's been very interesting, actually, for the United Kingdom throughout the coronavirus crisis. It's highlighted how the First Minister of Scotland, the First Minister of Wales, politicians in Northern Ireland have quite a lot of power in deciding what they want to do on public health matters. That's really been highlighted by the coronavirus crisis. And one minister I spoke to suggested that the whole thing hadn't been politically particularly good for the union. Boris Johnson says he sees things differently. He says the union's proved its worth in this crisis. And I think Downing Street's view is that whilst different areas have moved at different speeds, they're roughly moving towards the same thing. But also important to note that there are different political parties in charge of different areas across the United Kingdom. And it was quite interesting that today Mark Drakeford, who is the First Minister for Wales from the Labour Party, he was a little bit critical of Boris Johnson's Christmas hope, saying that that was taking a pretty sunny view of things. So I think tensions there, different ways of seeing things, perhaps slightly different levels of optimism. Of course, Boris Johnson from the rival Conservative Party.
Jessica Parker. Well, the new measures also mean music venues and theatres will be allowed to admit audiences for the first time since March. Strict social distancing will need to be in place. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd says the change is well timed for one of the world's great festivals of classical music, the Proms, which started on Friday evening.
This loosening of restrictions in concert halls and theatres applies to England only, but it's come sooner than many performers feared. Among events which might benefit are the BBC Promenade concerts, which start this weekend with a recorded mashup of all 9 Beethoven symphonies. We already knew that the last 2 weeks of the prom season would be of live music. Now there's a possibility that real live audiences may be there too to clap and cheer and cough. Artistic directors everywhere have been learning a new skill, auditorium trigonometry. Social distancing means venues will be lucky to fit in a quarter of their usual audience. The example of venues beyond the UK is being studied with interest. In many cases, alternate rows will be left empty and some other seats made out of bounds. And social distancing will apply on stage and in rehearsal too. Bars, a major source of
revenue will probably stay closed, and for now, the interval may be a thing of the past. The challenges, not least financial, for Britain's theatres and concert halls are many, but however uncertainly at first, the show will go on.
Vincent Dowd. More than 10,000 people in Southampton in southern England are being offered weekly saliva tests for coronavirus. It's a quicker and much less intrusive way of checking if someone has COVID-19 than the swab test, which the National Health Service currently relies upon. If the four-week pilot is successful, it could pave the way for the procedure to be used across the city and eventually the entire country. Our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh has been to meet some of those involved in the trial.
Right, so take your pots, take the lid off.
Jane Lees from Southampton is demonstrating the best method of delivering a saliva sample to her three teenage children. The family are part of a trial involving weekly testing of saliva. It's an alternative to nose and throat swabs, which Jane, who's a nurse at a GP surgery, says many find unpleasant.
The swab test is quite invasive, especially if you're not feeling very well. If you've got a cough, it can really trigger a cough by putting something in the back of your throat. So it is much, much easier to do.
The samples are sent to a lab which can process them in just 20 minutes, compared to several hours for swab tests. If the trial is successful, then the whole of Southampton, more than a quarter of a million people, could be offered weekly spit tests. Professor Keith Godfrey from the University of Southampton says it might mean coronavirus cases could be detected earlier, before outbreaks have a chance to spread.
It does seem that people become positive in their saliva before they even become positive in the rest of their breathing tubes, their respiratory tract. So if we're seeking to pick up this early spread, this may be the way forwards.
The key question is whether saliva tests are accurate enough to correctly identify those who are infected. There are a few scientists who are already convinced that weekly saliva testing of the entire UK population would bring a swift end to the epidemic. It would require 10 million tests a day, but if it worked, might mean an end to social distancing and other restrictions. Part of the solution to the COVID crisis might just be in our spit.
Fergus Walsh reporting. Coming up in the podcast.
It was the iconic aircraft, the one that everybody recognises, everybody could identify. It was particularly important, the 747, because it opened up the whole world to international travel.
British Airways is to retire all of its Boeing 747 jumbo jets from service immediately as a result of the sharp downturn in travel caused by COVID-19. Russia says it's prepared to mediate in peace talks between Armenia and Azerbaijan after fighting escalated along their shared border. The two rivals have been locked for decades in a conflict over the region of Nagorno-Karabakh. It lies inside Azerbaijan, but separatists from its ethnic Armenian majority gained control of the territory in a 1990s war that claimed 30,000 lives. The most recent flare-up in fighting began on Sunday, with both sides accusing the other of starting shelling that's continued sporadically for several days and so far has claimed a total of 17 lives. On Thursday, the BBC spoke to Hikmet Hajiyev, who's the assistant to the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. He gave his reaction to the escalation.
Patience of entire Azerbaijani people is running out. Strategic Azerbaijan demonstrated strategic patience for many years with regard to the occupation of Azerbaijani territories. And we engaged actively in the negotiation process and expecting that something can be achieved as a result of this negotiation process. But so far, nothing happened. And in more than 30 years, no inch of Azerbaijani territory returned back, no Azerbaijani IDPs returned back. And as if it's not enough, Armenia continues its military adventures, provocations against Azerbaijan.
James Kumarasamy spoke to Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and asked him first about the latest situation on the border.
We have, unfortunately, continuous tension. It started in Sunday evening when Azerbaijani army decided to attack our borders. And our army was forced to resist this move, and our army succeeded on that, but unfortunately we have second wave of attack, and now unfortunately we have quite tensioned situation, and this is a general picture of that.
Is the tension rising?
It is very difficult to assess, but you know, Turkey is interested very much in escalating situation, and I have an impression that Turkey is pushing Azerbaijan to start another attack, new attacks against Armenia. And also it has historic ground, because you know that in the beginning of 20th century, Turkey organized genocide of Armenian people, and it is connected maybe with history as well.
So Turkey is, as you say, strongly backing Azerbaijan. Are you getting any backing? Is Russia backing Armenia?
It is obvious that Russia, as a co-chair of OSCE Minsk Group, is following to neutral position, calling two sides to cease any military action.
Do you welcome that position, Russia standing in the middle, or would you like stronger backing?
You know, because we have no any intention to start military actions, we understand the position of OSCE co-chairs in general, but in this concrete moment, we think that they need to call to Azerbaijan not to start another military action, because we didn't start that, we haven't started that, and we have no intention to start another military action. It is Azerbaijan.
Well, Azerbaijan says that Armenia has also been shelling Azeri villages with high-caliber weapons, and that there have been at least one civilian
death.
You know,
it's our villages that weren't attacked by Azerbaijan. And now we have at least 4 villages that were attacked by Azerbaijan, and we have destroyed houses on that villages. And I'm afraid that Azerbaijan is trying to present the situation in opposite way.
Are you doing everything you can to keep civilians out of this? Because there is fighting, as you've acknowledged, on both sides.
Yeah, there are bomb shelters, etc., and people are spending big time of the day in the shelters.
Azerbaijan has also been threatening potentially to attack your nuclear power station. How credible a threat is that?
It's absurd. Do you imagine in 21st century a country threatening to attack nuclear power plant? It's a crime against humanity, because if we will really have any real move, it would affect not only Armenia, but Georgia, Iran, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Russia, and I think some more countries as well.
The Prime Minister of Armenia, Nikol Pashinyan, speaking to James Kumarasamy. Now, listen to this. That's the sound of a Boeing 747 taking off. British Airways says it's to retire all of its Boeing 747 jumbo jets from service immediately, as the airline suffers from the sharp travel downturn caused by the global pandemic. The British carrier has been the world's biggest operator of the planes, with 31 in the fleet. It had planned on phasing them out in 2024, but it's brought forward the date due to the impact of the coronavirus. The 747 earned many admirers over the years for its unique shape, the wide nose to accommodate the smaller first-class upper deck. James Menendez spoke to Alistair Rosenshine, a former BA 747 pilot and aviation consultant, and asked, did the aircraft deserve its nickname, the Queen of the Skies?
It most definitely was. It was, everybody says this word's overused, but it was the iconic aircraft, the one that everybody recognises, everybody could identify. There are only a very select few aircraft that the public could recognise so easily. But it was particularly important, the 747, because it opened up the whole world to international travel. So people with modest incomes could, in fact, go and see the other side of the world, literally.
And why was that? Just because of its size?
Well, because of its size, and it was very economical at the first. It could do this long range. It was they were able to price the tickets at more reasonable amounts so that more people were able to fly long haul, because before that it was the province of the wealthy.
I've been looking at some old pictures. I mean, there's lots going around today on social media of how the plane was configured back then. I mean, and it really was a golden age of travel. You have the upper deck, basically, either a restaurant or a lounge with sort of people just sitting around.
Well, the advertising showed that there was a bar up there, and there were different configurations depending on the airline, and these configurations within the aircraft changed over time. It became upper class at one point, first class at another point, but This whole idea that you could have such vast space in an aircraft was quite unheard of before. I mean, down in the economy section, or world traveller, as Bruchet always called it, the seats were 10 abreast with two aisles, and there was a staircase to go upstairs. It really was quite extraordinary, a flying block of flats and the most beautiful aircraft to fly.
Yes, I was going to say, what was it like as a pilot?
Well, most pilots aspired to one day flying a 747, and for me it happened in 1988, and I have to say it was the best year of my life, because not only did I fly the 747-200, but I was also selected to fly the very new and first course on the 747-400, which is a glass cockpit aircraft, and those are the aircraft that are retiring now because the earlier models went some time ago. But flying it, I mean, it was an absolute joy. It really was.
So efficient then, but according to British Airways, not efficient now compared to the, you know, newer aircraft.
Well, technology moves on. Aircraft engines become, more economical. The aircraft shape's more economical. They're using carbon fiber now. The wing tips have changed the shape of the aircraft. They fly slightly slower now, but more economically. In other words, they burn less fuel. And with the CO2 problems and global warming, it is, it's inevitable that aircraft will absolutely have to become more fuel economical. And sadly, 747 has reached the end of its life, and earlier than expected.
Alistair Rosenshine on the 747. A confectionery shop in Copenhagen has been handing out free Eskimo brand ice creams in protest at the maker's decision to drop the name to avoid offending Greenlanders. The makers, Hansen's Ice, said the word Eskimo was problematic and could not be defended. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
It's another aspect of reappraising the colonial past. In this case, Denmark's in Greenland. Denmark held sway there from the 18th century onwards and still controls its foreign and defence policy. Eskimo was a common word for the Inuit people. The woman handing out the free choc ices, Tina Wilstrup of Frederiksberg Chocolate, says history simply cannot be thrown away. But Aya Chemnitz Larsen, one of two Greenlanders in the Danish parliament, says that Eskimo is a disparaging colonial term meaning eater of raw meat. Replacing it is a matter of respect, she says.
Mike Sanders. The British Second World War veteran Captain Tom Moore, who raised more than $40 million for the National Health Service, has been knighted by Queen Elizabeth. It was the Queen's first public engagement since the start of the lockdown in March. Our correspondent, Helena Wilkinson, reports on a unique, socially distanced ceremony in the grounds of Windsor Castle outside London.
In the brilliant summer sunshine, in the grounds of the castle, Captain Sir Tom Moore's family were with him to share what he had described as this most special of days. His is the only honour to be bestowed since lockdown, an exception made because of his incredible achievement and the inspiration he provided for a nation in lockdown. Photographers captured the moment when the Queen, herself 94 years old, tapped him twice on each shoulder with a sword that belonged to her father. It was quite a moment for the Second World War veteran.
To meet the Queen was more than anyone could expect. I mean, it was... Never, never, ever did I imagine that I should get so close to the Queen and have such a kind message from her. That was really outstanding. It really was truly outstanding.
Britain's newest knight was then asked what the Queen had said to him.
That's between the Queen and I, yes. I don't think I'll tell anybody what she said.
The Queen did thank him for the extraordinary amount of money he'd raised and was overheard telling the former army captain, who turned 100 in April, that it was a great age.
So true. Helena Wilkinson reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Comb, a BBC World Service podcast.
The Comb, now.
The Comb.
Now, The Comb covers Africa. Obviously, Africa is a very big place.
Omar, you've been looking into this, right?
Yes, I have been. And honestly, Kim, it has been a big eye-opener.
But what we really want to tease out are some of the more universal themes that you find across Africa.
Do you take the well-paying job that you hate, or do you take the job where your passion lies?
As well as the themes and stories that are specific to certain countries.
You should see me in the public transport, tears streaming down my eyes.
And when you bring those two things together, the universal and the specific, you end up finding something quite unique that I think would appeal to listeners, not only in Africa, but around the world.
I still had that sense of pride to say I've made it.
That's The Comb, C-O-M-B, from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.
Finding the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Makiage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. ilmakiage.com/quiz.